This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have back in the studio here with me Terry Tempest Williams, one of my favorite writers in the whole world and a great environmental activist. Her amazing new book is entitled When Women Were Birds. Terry, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Matt, it's wonderful to be with you, and I have to add that you are my beloved editor of The Progressive, and it's such a privilege to write for you.
Well, thanks. That is a little bit of a disclosure that I probably should have mentioned at the top, that Terry Tempest Williams is a columnist for The Progressive and has been just a huge addition to the magazine over the last couple of years. Love this book. Why don't you just read the opening, because I think it establishes so much of where the book goes. Not all of it, but some of it.
Thank you. I am 54 years old, the age my mother was when she died. This is what I remember. We were lying on her bed with a mohair blanket covering us. I was rubbing her back, feeling each vertebra with my fingers as a rung on a ladder. It was January, and the ruthless clamp of cold bore down on us outside. Yet inside, Mother's tenderness and clarity of mind carried its own warmth. She was dying in the same way she was living, consciously. I am leaving you all my journal, she said, facing the shuttered window as I continued rubbing her back. But you must promise me that you will not look at them until after I am gone. I gave her my word, and then she told me where they were. I didn't know my mother kept journals. A week later, she died. A month later, I found myself alone in the family home. I kept expecting Mother to appear. Her absence became her presence. It was the right time to read her journals. They were exactly where she said they would be. Three shelves of beautiful cloth-bound books. Some floral, some paisley, others in solid colors. The spines of each were perfectly aligned against the lip of the shelves. I opened the first journal. It was empty. I opened the second journal. It was empty. I opened the third, it too was empty, as was the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, shelf after shelf after shelf. All my mother's journals were blank.
That's Terry Tempest Williams reading that powerful opening to her new book entitled When Women Were Birds. And you go through a lot of different alternative explanations for why she didn't write in this journal and why she left them to you. And my favorite kind of juxtaposed couplet of yours in here on that subject is, my mother's journals are a charity, my mother's journals are a cruelty. Do you want to explain that?
I still feel that way. You know, and you're right. I think that embodies the paradox. They felt like a second death. I remember being stunned. On some level, I still am, you know, and on one hand, it did feel like this terrible cruelty. On the other hand, it did feel like this amazing charity, this generosity. Feel them. But that's too easy. The cruelty's too easy. I think it's this, that, and all of it.
Right. But the cruelty would be the command to fill them, or the cruelty was, I'm not going to tell you about my life?
Such a good point, Matt. I mean, I think at first I would say the cruelty was the shock, the disappointment, because of the expectation that I was going to learn about my mother's life. She was a very private woman. She was not a silent one. And as you know, in the book, it's filled with her letters and talks, so you see her eloquence. So I do think it was a conscious decision. My mother knew that I kept journals, that I had hundreds of journals. It's what Mormon women do. We write. So in that sense, I think this was an act of defiance from a Mormon woman who had been told all her lives that you keep a journal, you record your life, you keep a record for posterity. She did not. But in so many other ways, it was this generosity, because it allowed me / forced me to really think about her life and what she was saying, what she was not saying.
You know, let's talk a little bit more about your mom, because as you mentioned, those letters of hers where she actually did write, and she was so loving as a mother to you, so expressive and grateful in expressing her gratitude to you, so affirming, that must have been rewarding to have and be able to hold on to.
I think that's why I did and do. You know, each letter is precious, which I think letters are precious, and they're becoming more rare, I think, in this age of email and Twitter and, you know, more superficial correspondences. You know, my mother would say that she did not know how to express herself. I don't think that's true. I just don't think she wanted people to know what she thought. And it's funny, I was thinking, in my own journals, they're not private because I have this sense that someone will read them. My books are much more personal because I have the sense no one reads them, you know, which is this strange sort of dichotomy. But, you know, in our keeping, we have generations of Mormon women's journals.
You say of your mother, she's one of the deepest and one of the most shallow women you knew. That was a surprise for me to hear, too.
You know, but I tell the story about Elizabeth Taylor, right? My mother was obsessed with Elizabeth Taylor. They were born on the same day, same year. Growing up, photoplay was everywhere alongside my father's sporting good news. We knew every marriage Liz Taylor ever had. And, you know, she said, "Terry, let's go to New York. I want to go see Lillian Hellman's wonderful play, Little Foxes. Elizabeth Taylor is starring in it." I thought, fabulous. We go. We watch. She's incredible. The climax is building. My mother stands up and says, "We must go." And I was saying, "There's no way. We, you know, the play is not over. I want to see how it ends." Meanwhile, everyone's saying, "Shh, sit down." And my mother leaves. I walk. I follow her. We're on the street. I said, "What is up?" And she said, "We have to be at Sardi's before Liz Taylor gets there." And I just went, "I cannot believe we went all this way to see this play, and the real point is to see Miss Taylor when she arrives at Sardi's," which she did, like clockwork, in her purple caftan and jewels. We're sitting in the front parlor, as it were. My mother trips her. And Elizabeth Taylor says, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And my mother says, "Not at all, no worries." And they have a conversation. You know, that's what I'm talking about.
She must have loved that. On the other hand, she fought for the ERA. She enrolled in a feminist theory class as a Mormon woman. That must not have been the most common thing to do. There is this in your family, this tradition of feminist women, which is intriguing.
And I don't think it's unusual within Mormon families. You know, Mormon women, in many ways, run the local churches. That's a fact. And I do come from a long lineage of strong Mormon women. And my mother was an exemplar of that.
Now, you, in that opening, Terry Tempest Williams, that you read so beautifully for us, you talk about your mother dying when she was 54, and you being 54, you're a couple years older than that now, or a year or two older than that now. Did you feel like you were going to die when you were 54? Because I have friends whose father, guys whose fathers died young, and they dreaded that year. They thought it was built into the cards.
It's a strange psychological moment when you realize you are the age that your mother was when she died. I didn't realize how young she was. You know, I thought, my goodness. So she was just coming into her own power. I mean, that's what it feels like. I didn't think I was going to die. I was just very mindful that that was the age that she was when she did. But the irony was, 2 weeks after I did turn 54, I did receive a diagnosis where it was life-threatening, with a hemangioma in my brain that sits on the Wernicke part of my brain that oversees language.
And you talk about this at the end of this book, When Women Were Birds, and it just struck me. I knew about it because we're friends and you've written for The Progressive and you confided in me, but it was so powerful to come at the end. I didn't know whether you were going to disclose it or not. This is a book dedicated to your mother, dedicated to birds, but also dedicated to words. And you talk about, you know, you write, therefore you are, essentially, and yet you have this blood spill in your brain, right, where control of words lies. How do you wrestle with that? How do you contend with the possibility that, A, you know, essentially you could die at any time, and B, or you could just lose your capacity to write or to use words.
It's amazing what we adapt to, isn't it? I'm not sure what the fine line is between acceptance and denial. I think denial is a very powerful emotion. So I don't know. I mean, you go on. And I think early on, it was a shock. I kept thinking, this is not my story. This is not my story. Now I realize this is my story. This is my life. You and I went bird watching today. You know, it doesn't get any better than that, than to see an indigo bunting. There are times where I have a bleed and I feel like I'm underwater. I feel like a sea anemone, a sentient being without full capacity of language. I'm not sure anyone else would recognize it. I do.
So at that time, you're unable to talk? Is it like a stroke where you can't talk?
Or I can speak, but it's like you go into your brain and you choose your words off a shelf carefully. That's the only way I can describe it.
So you talk in a real halting way?
Yeah, and it sounds like you're being very thoughtful. When in fact there's a certain kind of panic. You know, I think I remember when the surgeon said, and this is not unusual, we all have our health issues. He basically said I would have surgery yesterday. And when I heard about what that would involve and the risk of neurological deficit, you know, I said, I choose to do nothing. And he looked at me and he said, how well do you live with uncertainty? And I remember looking at him and saying, what else is there? And I believe that.
I thought it was a good question. I thought it was a really good answer, too. I mean, I think some doctors would not have asked such a philosophical question, I think. And yet we all have to deal with uncertainty.
Absolutely.
I mean, sooner or later, we all have to deal with mortality, and certainly we have to deal with the uncertainty surrounding mortality. And yet there are times when people are dealing with life and death questions, and I had a little health scare myself in the last year, and, you know, sometimes impulse goes through my brain, which is, you know, kind of existentialist, you know. And so my joke was with friends that, you know, I was an existentialist before I was a leftist, so I'm going to take this, you know, kind of in stride, but...
I mean, how do you handle that?
Well, a lot of times just ignoring denials, what you said. And the other thing is just trying to enjoy day-to-day, though that had kind of been my philosophy over the last many years anyway. But, you know, you have a line in your book, Terry Tempest Williams, toward the end, you know, life is about celebration.
It is.
And so we try to celebrate, my wife and I, and I try to celebrate in the joys that I take. I'm all about regular joys, you know. Yeah. I'm not about taking the one vacation on the bucket list to wherever. Yeah. So I try to take my joys in a quotidian way. You know, if I play basketball at noontime, or if you know, I go bird watching in the morning, or play poker with my friends or my sons. You know,
and isn't that life?
Those are joys.
I mean, today, really, with you this morning at Picnic Point, it changes the whole complexion and consciousness of the day. And I love that. And yeah. I think that's what my mother was really saying. I mean, my mother, every day of her life, she was diagnosed with breast cancer at 38. She had four children. Every day, what I remember of my mother is that at sunset, she would quietly go out and applaud the sunset.
Hmm. That's wonderful. Birds, you're in the title, When Women Were Birds. There are a lot of birds in this book, and there's a lot of discussion about women. How did your fascination with birds come about?
I was 5 years old. My grandmother gave me a Peterson's Field Guide to Western Birds, and I love that you told me this morning that at about that age you were reading the Eastern Field Guide, Peterson's Field Guide to Birds, right?
Yeah, it's kind of bookends, you know. You were covering the west of the Mississippi, and I was covering the east as little kids, geeky little kids memorizing bird plates.
And I love that. And today we saw an Eastern Kingbird, you know, the great crested flycatcher, and I think about the Western Kingbirds, you know, the Gila woodpecker, which translates to what, the
red-bellied woodpecker here, yeah.
So I love these correspondences, the indigo bunting with the lazula bunting.
Yeah, these are little mirrors.
Yeah, they
across
are.
Across the Mississippi River.
With niches and time and space. I've always loved birds. They always felt like mediators between heaven and earth. I viewed them as family. When I see the long-billed curlew has returned on the flanks of Antelope Island on the edge of Great Salt Lake, it allows me to be hopeful again.
There is that grounding in the cycles of nature and the bird migrations. And Wendell Berry has a great poem that he wrote during the Vietnam War about, you know, in the midst of the bombings, he goes out and works in the garden or goes into the woods and listens for a bird. So
I mean, just
I do
this
think
morning,
that is a settling, a reorienting, recentering kind of a practice.
Well, I was thinking this morning, I mean, talk about the Pleistocene, hearing that unbelievable call of the sandhill crane. You know, on the eve of this election with Scott Walker and Mayor Barrett, and, you know, 9 million years of perfection flying over us, it sort of puts things in perspective, doesn't it?
It does, and there's that great bit in this book of yours, Terry Tempest Williams, where you tell one of your mentors that you saw the sandhill cranes mating and how tremendous it was. And
the first person to ever see this, man.
That's basically what he said had been going on for 9 million years. But
exactly.
Glad you enjoyed it. There's also a part in here, I like this little story early on. Your grandmother is a huge presence in this book, and she was a force too, and a wonderful, very strong and kind of a defiant woman who just wanted to stand for convention. And she had this advice. You went out and you saw an albino robin, and you reported it. You were young. How old were you?
I think I was eight.
Under 10, yeah. And you reported it to the Audubon Society, and they wouldn't believe you or wouldn't record it because you were too young. And she had this advice: the bird doesn't need to be counted, and neither do you. And when I first read that, I kind of gasped because I thought it was a put-down. But then I read it again and saw it as, you know, this is a really profound statement. You know, you can enjoy the bird without counting the bird, and certainly the bird is there and doesn't need us to enjoy its life.
That was a turning point, you know, and this book is all about turning points of where one finds one's voice, where you lose it, where you reclaim it, and it's not static. I think it's a constant evolving struggle. I'll use that word. But at that moment, I so wanted to be believed, because it was so rare and so unusual. And I'll never forget when she said that. And, you know, I've never counted birds since. I don't know what my life list is. You know, and I hear about people saying, oh, it's 700-something,
number 321,
something.
321.
Or 300, yeah. And I don't know what that means, because after that day, every bird feels individual to me.
Yeah, I stopped counting birds when I got to Madison about 2 months after the spring here, where I was at the exact same spot we were today at Picnic Point, Madison, Wisconsin. And I was coming back and I asked this elderly couple, the woman, what she had seen. Had she seen anything unusual? And she says, oh, you're one of those counters. And then it struck me, wow, maybe I am just draining the color out of every bird I see, because I'm just trying to check it off the stinking list I got. And at the same time, you know, as writers, and this is a book about voice, 54 Variations on Voice, that may not be the precise subtitle, but it's something like that. We want to be counted as writers, mm-hmm. As political activists, as human beings on the face of the earth. We want to be counted. We want to make a difference. We want to be heard. We want to be acknowledged. And yet there's a piece in here where you say you write sometimes just for yourself privately. And this I didn't know was quite interesting, that you write over your lines, physically writing over the line, so it's illegible, unreadable, incomprehensible.
I do. I just filled.
And what's that about?
I just filled a whole placemat last night, as a matter of fact. I call them repetitions. What's that about? I don't know. I think, you know, I'm my mother's sister. You know, there's that line in the book where I say, if only my mother had known that I was her sister rather than her daughter. You know, paradox, these contradictions. Yes, we write to be read. Yes, we have a voice to be heard. On the other side, writing is a process by which I find out what I think. Writing is a means to find out who I am, and that's not public. So I think disclosure is not always, public disclosure is not always the ideal. So last night I was taking a difficult subject and I was doing repetitions, almost like meditations, where you write a line, you write over it, you write over it, you write over it. and they almost look like these strange hieroglyphics. And by the time that I'm through, I have a better sense of my soul.
And the physical act of writing with an instrument, a pen or a pencil, it may get to a point, a spot in the brain that just writing on the computer doesn't, so maybe that's helpful too. But this idea that writing is kind of pre-public, I kind of like that idea. I hadn't thought of it in those ways before. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine, and you're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Terry Tempest Williams, the great essayist and teacher and environmentalist whose latest book is When Women Were Birds. And there is just so much about women in here. I just pulled out a couple quotes because it's, you know, almost like Thoreau here, because you're so writing an epigram sometimes. The language of women so often begins with a whisper. Women have always written in code as a way to protect themselves. And then this one about women's relationships. The sin we commit against each other as women is lack of support. We hurt each other, we hide, we project. And there's an allusion in here to a relationship you had with a woman friend who got alienated from you, or you alienated her, or she did something to you. Do you want to talk about that?
This is why you're such a stunning editor. You know, you go right to the heart. Do I want to talk about that? I don't think I do, except for to say, you know, it's about privacy. I mean, I could talk to you about it, but the way in which these get transcribed on the web, I'm acutely aware of the privacy of the other person that we would be talking about. I think that when you have these really, really close relationships, and when it's involving family and death, things fall apart. And oftentimes the casualties are the closest, the people who are closest to each other. Because the relationship has to take a different configuration. And for my family, you know, each death that we have shared, the family gets shattered. And then we create a different kind of mosaic. And I think that's what we're in the presence of now.
And how do you write about family while family is alive? And you teach essay writing to students, too, and I don't know how you instruct them on that, but that is so hard, I would think, to write about family.
It's a minefield. And, you know, I think I'm done. You know, I'm really happy I'm in Madison and not in Utah right now. It's really hard, and yet how do you tell the truth? And what I do believe is that those things which are most personal are most general. I think you have to use discernment to find out what is private and what is personal. And there's a real difference there. You know, and in this book, there's some very tough pieces with my father-in-law in particular. And yet it was a absolute seminal moment of where I realized I had to claim my voice. And my father-in-law pushed the issue of integrity in terms of my own relationship to the religion, Mormonism. And I wrote about it, and it had to do with the Greenbelt movement in Kenya with Wangari Maathai. And he was asking for a Faustian bargain, and I said no. And I wrote him a letter before the book came out and thanked him. I sent him the galleys, and I said, I don't know how you're going to feel about this, but here's what's behind it. And he wrote me back, and it was a very loving but tough letter. So, you know, I've made the decision that with each family member, I give them what I'm publishing before. There's certainly grounds to negotiate, but then there's a line where I have to call it, and it's never easy. I think relationships are stretched, but I think respect is gleaned on both sides, I hope.
And you talk about courage and just bravery. And in that way, that kind of writing is courageous and brave. I think writing about family, it's a subject I avoid, I tend to avoid anyway. There's this one last line about women and men in this book, When Women Were Birds, that I just plucked out. And that is, if a man knew what a woman never forgets, he would love her differently.
And Matt, you know where that came from. I mean, this is why I love writing for the Progressive and why I love working with you as an editor. That section on abortion, reproductive rights, came straight out of the column, my column, and you were my editor. And I'm so grateful for the voice that you inspired in me in this book. And I'm not saying this because you're my friend. I'm not saying this because this is Progressive Magazine. The point is I think that we don't even know what comes out of us. And I think those monthly assignments show us what is on our mind. And that was written in the height of the Republican discourse of a woman's right to choose. It was after I had been at a very private meeting with healthcare providers, abortion providers in Utah at a clandestine location. And I think in many ways that's the heart of this book.
It's really powerful. You use an expression a couple times in this book, and I didn't read it on Kindle and count them. I guess you can do that now. Must be wonderful for English majors around the country. Anyway, the expression is a stay. In times of war, you use your voice as a stay against those who are suffering. And then in another place you write, good work is a stay against despair. And so, you know, it's as though, do you believe there's, you know, there's an execution awaiting us if we don't do this good work or use our voice?
You know, I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting to me. I mean, what does a stay mean? A pause? How would you define that?
Well, I read it, you know, a stay of execution. That was the immediate thing that came through mind. So there's a stay.
Well, that's so interesting. I think we pay a price. I thought I was writing a book about voice. I think in many ways this is a book about silence and silences. The silence that nourishes us, that feeds creativity, to be silenced, the silence that destroys us. I think about Audre Lorde when she says, our silences will not protect us. So in that sense, it is a self-execution, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we are the toughest on ourselves. I mean, yes, we are silenced by institutions. Yes, we may be silenced by government, you know, in different situations, but I think the most brutal silencing is our own self-censorship out of fear. What are we really afraid of?
I'm speaking with Terry Tempest Williams. Her latest book, which I can't recommend more highly, it's just an incredible book. It's called When Women Were Birds. It's about women. It's about birds. It's about using your voice. There's my favorite quote in this whole book, and there are so many, is the following. We can change the world if our view is long and focused with friends drawn lovingly around the place we call home. I love that because I think people need to be surrounded by friends and do a good work in a joyful kind of way and in a communal kind of way. And so that's just beautiful, drawn lovingly around the place we call home. How'd you get around to writing that?
I believe it. I mean, you've been sharing your home with me here. I just wrote a letter to Brooke, my husband. We just celebrated our 37th anniversary. I said, everything will be better once I get home. I feel that way.
So, unfortunately, we're out of time. Terry Tempest Williams, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
It's my pleasure, a real pleasure and an honor. And the book is When Women Were Birds. If you've been listening, go get that book.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.